Welcome to the Partially Examined Life, episode 130, part 2. Last time we began our discussion of Aristotle's De Anima, talking about the overall project, what he means by anima or soul or life force, how it is the form in Aristotelian terms of the living body, spending most of our time on part 1 of book 2. This time we're going to talk about plants, about animals, more about forms and causality.
All right, what's next to the next?
Section 2.
Should I just read some to show you why this would make me fall asleep? Since it is from things which are obscure but more obvious that we arrive at that which is clear and more intelligible in respect of the principle involved, we must try again in this way to treat of the soul. For a defining statement, and this translation has the L as a subscript for both defining statement and principle, because it's logos. Go listen to our Heraclitus episode to find out all about logos. For defining statement should not only make clear the fact, as the majority of definitions do, but it should also contain and reveal the reason for it. As things are, these statements, in other words, logos, of the definitions are like conclusions. For example, what is squaring? The construction of an equilateral rectangle equal to one which is not equilateral. But such a definition is a statement, logos, of the conclusion, whereas one who says that squaring is the discovery of the mean proportional states, is the discovery of the mean proportional states the reason for the circumstance? So you guys, do you find that fascinating? This was the D.W. Hamlin translation that we're going to be linking people to online, because at least it has the verse numbers here.
Well, it's certainly true that reading Aristotle can be pretty tiring.
What's the first thing in chapter 2 here that you want to make something of? Probably it's not comparing something to a rectangle, but what?
It's the second paragraph where he continues on how being ensouled is what distinguishes dead things from live things, or what it means, the soulless, to being alive, and he outlines the properties of the soul.
You want to try my translation?
Okay.
Oh, this is 4:13a20.
Yeah, right? It's the second paragraph, yeah.
Let us then, taking up the starting point of our inquiry, say that the ensouled is distinguished from the unsouled by its being alive. Now, since being alive is spoken of in many ways, even if only one of these is present, we say that the thing is alive if, for instance, there is intellect or perception or spatial movement and rest, or indeed movement connected with nourishment and growth and decay. It is for this reason that all the plants are also held to be alive, for they clearly have within themselves potentiality and a principle of the right kind, through which they take growth and decay in opposite directions. Then it's going to go on from there. Let me skip a sentence.
So potentiality can also be translated as capacity.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Dunamis.
Well, that part that you were about to skip.
You want me to read it?
Has to do with, sure.
Okay. For it is not that they grow upwards, but not downwards, but in the same way in both directions, indeed in all directions, as many of them, that is, that are regularly nourished and so go on living as long as they are able to take nourishment. Now this faculty, meaning nourishment, can be separated from the others, but the others cannot be separated from this in mortal things. And this is obvious in the case of plants, as they have no other capacity of the soul. All living things then have life in virtue of this principle, but they are not animals unless they have perception. For indeed of those things that without moving or changing place yet have perception, we say not just that they are live, but they are animals. Further, the most basic of senses, touch, all animals have, so that just as the nutritive faculty is separable from touch and all perception, so is touch separable from other senses. We call nutritive that part of the soul in which even plants partake, while it is clear that all animals have the sense of touch. But for what reason these two things should be so, we will say later.
So it's really interesting about this whole plant thing is that, you know, it's as if you could take one aspect of our, what it means to be alive for us being human, this, you know, the nutritive part, and then you could, you know, you have this sort of visible manifestation of something which is solely nutritive. It's like a, you know, as if we had externalized one part of ourselves. And the physical form of the plant almost reveals what we mean by the nutritive faculty, the way in which it's a kind of manifestation of it. The way plants grow everywhere in all directions. And
in other words, they're not purely earth, because then they would just grow down, or purely air, they would just grow up. That's why I was, that kind of, the four elements thing is lurking in the background everywhere here.
Exactly. Yeah. They're not simply subject to gravity. There's some other force in them that can move upwards. Yeah. It can go up or down. It's not, you know, so it's neither gravity nor whatever takes air upwards. It's its own inner force as opposed to those outer forces.
Or is it fire that goes up, not air? I don't remember now.
Fire goes up.
Okay. Because otherwise all the air on earth would fly up to the heavens and we would all choke. So That makes sense.
But I misspoke there about inner force, because it's inner in the rock that falls. I think it's supposed to be an inner force as well. So an inner movement from within, but it goes down only as opposed to being able to go up.
So any other comments on that section? I mean, that's already, I'm glad you read that much, Seth. It's very hard for me to tell when reading something like this, is he actually giving us an explanation or is he just categorizing? Because that's really what explanation amounts to quite a bit for Aristotle, I think pretty explicitly, is just being able to saying what life is here. He thinks he's giving an explanation for what life is by just saying, well, okay, life is what makes things have certain capacities, and here are the different kinds of capacities, and different kinds of life have different kinds of capacities, and so they are exercising different faculties of the soul or have souls with different capacities, something like that. But it's sort of just laying out a table of here are all the organisms and here's the one faculty, the nutritive that they all have in common and the sense perceptive, more of them have in common, and they map very well onto plant, animal, and us, the three different faculties.
So I don't think it's just categorization. I think he's building an argument and he's starting with obvious phenomena.
Yeah. And I think a good example of that is right after where Seth was reading is, you're right, Mark. He's always sort of categorizing things in certain ways, but he also falls back and also begins asking sensible questions about it. So he'll say, after he outlines these different parts of the soul, he says, we will explain later the cause of each of these things falling out as they do. For now, let us say only that the soul is the governing principle of the things mentioned, nutritive, perceptive, thinking, and moving, and is bounded by them. Is each of these a soul or a part of a soul? And if a part, is it such that as to be separable only in logos or also in locus? While some of these things are not difficult to see, some involve perplexity. For just as in the case of plants, where some cuttings clearly go on living, even when separated from one another, so we also see the same thing happening in other kinds of soul in the case of insects when they are cut. Each of the parts has perception and motion with respect to place, and if perception, then also imagination and desire. For where there is perception, there is also pain and pleasure, and where these are, there is necessarily appetite. In the case of intellect and contemplative capacity, it is not at all clear, but it seems that this is another kind of soul, and that this alone is able to exist separately. And he goes on.
Oh, just to hearken back to we didn't spend too much time on the beginning of the book, but I mean the whole book, but he talks about discussing the methodological challenges, like how do you approach this and is the methodology that we know from one type of inquiry appropriate for this? And I think it's important because what he's saying is he's established that there's this thing that what it is to be alive. And then he starts saying, okay, now let's look at living things and what do they have in common, or what are the characteristics that distinguish them as living, right? So the nutritive and perception and all that. And I think he's doing what he does, which is making distinctions, but he's also methodologically saying, he's establishing that there's a connection between the having of this particular function and the being alive, without saying specifically that it has any particular relationship that he wants to clarify at this point, like it's an attribute or a function or what have you. So in a sense, Mark, he is doing a categorization, as you mentioned, but he is also making a claim when he's saying that this is a part of the soul. All he's saying is that what it means to be alive is to have at least one of these three things. Mm-hmm. My point is it's a claim. It's not just a taxonomy.
So yeah, if you go back to 4:13b11-13, he calls it the soul, the arche, the principle or the beginning or the source, you could say, of all these faculties, which I count four of them, nutrition, sensation, thought, and movement.
I had five, actually.
Did you?
Generation.
Well, nutrition, the nutritive faculty includes...
You have growth in that?
Growth and reproduction.
Okay. I had those separate.
Don't perception and locomotion go together at least?
No, locomotion's separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because perception, all animals have perception, but not all animals have locomotion.
Locomotion, yeah.
He talks about animals that don't have locomotion but have touch and perception, yeah, that aren't plants.
Exactly.
So I don't know what he was thinking of. Coral?
Like a sponge, yeah.
Clams?
So I have intellect, perception, locomotion, and nutritive.
I think it's debatable whether you have intellect, Ellen.
I was going to say, yeah, I have all of those except for the intellect.
So I found it interesting, again, this sort of non-anthropocentric take on motivation. For where there is sense perception, there is also both pain and pleasure. And where these, there is of necessity also wanting, or whatever your translation
appetite.
Is.
Appetite.
Desire.
Mm-hmm.
We all have different things, but they all mean the same thing. So these things are being defined functionally. Normally, when we would think of it, we would think of wanting or desire, pain and pleasure as phenomenal qualities. And he's not making a claim either way. I mean, this was not really on his radar of does the animal really have an inner life, or does a plant really have, does a plant even have inner life? If it doesn't have, I mean, he'll talk about whether it has intellect or not, but a sense perception means you have imagination and desire. So that means, yeah, the fact that you can imagine, I don't know, is it clear? Like if you see an ant crawling towards something, that the ant is imagining what it would be like to get there and have that thing. And so then it wants that thing. And when it gets there, it will feel pleasure. Like that's for an ant in particular. Other animals we don't have any problem with, but for insects might be a little too phenomenal talk for us. But he's just defining these things functionally, not phenomenally. Pain is the thing that pushes you away, and pleasure is the thing that pulls you towards. I don't know. Is that something in the Greek, or is that just, do you know what pain and pleasure and desire?
Desire is epithumia.
Does that imply a phenomenal desire? I mean,
he's talking about pain and pleasure and the way that we mean pain and pleasure. And pleasure is hedone, as in where we get hedonism from, hedone.
So you would not say wherever there is telos. So is there telos when a rock falls? This is what I just forget.
I think so.
Okay. So it's a very simple kind of telos. It's not a kind of telos where it holds an end in front of itself in imagination, and it certainly doesn't rejoice when it reaches the ground. It's not anthropocentric in that. But would you say that it desires to go down in any sense? Or does desire really does imply some phenomenal quality that you'd only have when you have imagination and sense perception and the rest of it?
I think in this context, he's definitely talking about human or animals having subjective states. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to imply that he's a behavioralist here. And in fact, the whole point about pain and pleasure, and the point this guy makes in the commentary, that the relationship between that and desire is that just pain is it's a sensation plus the desire that sensation be gone. And pleasure is a sensation plus the desire that the sensation continue. So that's why pain and pleasure are supposed to imply desire. And then imagination is something called fantasia in the Greek. It's usually translated quite differently in other... Did you guys all have imagination for that?
I had imagination, yeah.
Okay.
I totally just missed my chance there. Give the Greek again, Wes.
Fantasia.
Whoa, whoa. It's not the real thing. Whoa, whoa. No? Nobody referenced? All right, never mind.
What is that?
I got it.
It's a song.
I couldn't tell you. Oh, it's Billy Joel. There you go.
So I think the imagination part of this is just the idea that we can, it's very simple, conjure up. We don't have to be having a sensation of something in order for it to be before our minds in some sense. We can imagine a thing as opposed to simply directly experiencing it. And we're doing that, for instance, when we're using our imagination, when we have this idea of, I want the pain to be gone, because we're imagining it being gone. So all these things work very closely together. Desire, imagination, and pain and pleasure. To desire something, you have to be able to imagine what it is you desire, even though it's immediately absent from you.
It doesn't resonate phenomenologically with me, but the phenomenology in question is me imagining I was a simple animal feeling pain, and it's not, I'm imagining that there's no pain and I want that instead of this. That seems too complicated.
Well, Aristotle thinks that animals can have opinions. It's not in the way that we have, you know.
Oh, because they could be wrong. They could think that they would be happier without the pain.
Yeah, they have thinking, for sure, in Aristotle.
Well, he doesn't spend a lot of time trying to tease any of this stuff out either, though.
Perhaps that's in his other work, History of Animals.
A dog that gets excited when you are about to take it for a walk has imagination. You couldn't do that without imagination.
Yep.
The important thing is that when he says imagination, he's not thinking of it the way it's tied to this notion of perception. It's somehow connected to the ability to perceive, not so much to the intellect, whereas imagination as we think of it now is much more a cognitive faculty than it is related to perception.
Well, so what you're saying is that we don't necessarily take it on face value as imagination is making images in our minds. which is what a dog is doing when it gets excited about anticipating going for a walk. Because
except it's not an image, it's a smell-based image. It's just all these are the smells that we'll have.
My dog is utterly visual, right? As soon as I show up with the leash, the dog freaks out. He knows he's going out for a walk.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be imagistic per se in the sense of, I mean, when we say image here, that's broadly speaking, it doesn't mean that he's envisioning grass and balls being thrown at him, or good, although it could be. I mean, obviously, if you've seen dogs dream, you know they have the capacity for that type of imaging, but it could be anything. It could be purely affective. It could, you know, as in the sense of feelings, imagining certain feelings or something like that. So, or smell or taste or, you know.
Yeah, sure.
There's a whole range of, things that we mean by image. We're not attributing human faculties to an animal simply by claiming that they have an imagination here. It's a question of what their imagination involves, but I think you'd have a hard case to make if you wanted to say animals don't have imagination, given that they perform all these behaviors we've been talking about.
Yeah, I don't think it's ultimately a make or break point in this particular section of the text, but he does make a side note about how if it does involve imagination, there may be some more complications because he's trying to distinguish between the functions of the soul or the parts of the soul that require embodiment or that are not separable from those that are. And he states that imagination might complicate things.
Is it not intellect?
Well, the nutritive and the perceptive pieces are not separable from a body. You can't take in nutrition and have growth, and you can't have perception without a body. But he says the intellectual seems like it's different, and it could be separable, but it's not clear that it is.
Right. So that's nous. So imagination isn't part of that. It's a separate thing. So Dylan, I thought you might have been suggesting they had intellect or nous as well. From my understanding, and I may be wrong, animals have imagination and perception, sensation, but non-human animals don't have nous. They don't have intellect. But I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, I think you may be right in that Aristotle is making that distinction, and I'll just have to pay more attention when we do book three about that.
Is nous reason too? Is that another translation? Intellect and reason are the same thing?
They might be translating it as reason, yeah, or mind, yeah.
Okay. When I listened ahead into book three, he talks about that humans have the ability to ignore desire because they're listening to reason instead, which would be the thing that animals don't have. So it's not that reason, it's not that intellect is adding the whole phenomenal realm, as we were just saying, that animals have a phenomenology, they have a imagination, they have desires, blah, blah, blah. It's just that when they have desires, they can't resist them because they don't have this extra, more abstract faculty.
Yeah, and what Seth was saying is that, you know, he kind of hints that maybe intellect is separable, is a separable sort of soul function that in the way that the others aren't, which is a kind of weird given everything else he said, and I don't yet know why he thinks so.
Right, yeah. So 4.13b.24, concerning the intellect and the potentiality for contemplation, the situation is not so far clear, but it seems to be a different kind of soul, and this alone can exist separately as the everlasting can from the perishable. So yeah, clearly he's just referring to other parts of his corpus. If reason is a matter of contemplating the everlasting, is a matter of contemplating numbers and things like that. And he seems to have this very literal, we'll get into when we talk about perception and things probably next time, have a very literal idea of, you know, when I perceive red, part of the fluid in my eye, at least on one way of reading this, becomes red. Like he has these very literal. So that might be, and this sounds like Spinoza to me, that when we contemplate numbers or eternal things, that we are somehow partaking of the eternal. I mean, that sounds like Plato, frankly. So maybe this is something that is the source of Aristotle's intuition here. That's why it seems like it could be different, because reason is not thinking of these moment-to-moment things. It's thinking of things that have being that is outside time anyway.
Yeah, and he goes on other places where he has this sort of perplexity regarding whether or not at least part of the soul, the intellect, could be separable from the body. He also explains how the intellect seems to somehow take part of stillness more than motion and permanence rather than transience. And that is in part a sign to him that at least a perplexity, if not that maybe the intellect is somehow separable.
So if it is separable, it would not be a poltergeist. It would not be moving around, throwing things.
No. So we'll talk more about this at the end of book three.
All right, so let's table that. Let's stop for a second and talk about our sponsor, The Great Courses.
We are big fans of the Great Courses. We love learning about so many things at our own pace for the pure pleasure of it. And that's why we're excited about something new from the Great Courses. It's the Great Courses Plus Video Learning Service with unlimited access to thousands of fascinating subjects. The Great Courses Plus has nearly 5,000 video lectures in subjects like history, science, photography, cooking, of course, philosophy, and more, taught by award-winning professors and experts from National Geographic, the Smithsonian, and the Culinary Institute of America. With the Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want at any time from anywhere on your TV, laptop, tablet, or phone. Partially Examined listeners can get a new introductory offer to the Great Courses Plus free for 1 month. The Great Courses lecture series are normally priced at $200 to $300 each, but now you can get unlimited access to the entire Great Courses Plus library completely free for 1 month. So go sign up now for your free 1 month trial. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
What else do we want to talk about here?
We could jump to the part where he starts talking about the that for the sake of which. So this is 415b. So he suggests that reproduction is for the sake of the eternal. And then he gets into these two senses of the final cause, which is the purpose and the benefit.
So he says, soul is the cause and a governing principle of the living body, but these things may be meant in various ways, and likewise the soul is a cause in three distinct ways. The soul is a cause as an origin of motion, as that for the sake of which, and as the substantial being of ensouled bodies.
Okay, from the motion is the efficient cause.
Yep, for the sake of which
is the final cause, and then the substance is the formal. Yeah.
Yep, so in my translation, he ends the section, he says, that it is, that soul is a substantial being is clear. The substantial being is the cause of the being of each thing. Living is the being of living things, and soul is the cause and governing principle of these.
Do we know what he means here?
Well, I think you have to unpack it, right?
Yeah.
Because in any of these translations, I think if you just start saying what it is, it requires to be unpacked because all the rest of the text is helping you understand it. So substantial being in this translation is translating usia.
Tell me again what verse this is exactly.
415.
415b10, okay.
And then the part where he says it's obvious is more around 14 or something. The soul is the cause in the sense of substance is obvious. By the way, I said something about usia and totie anai, which is wrong before. So the totie anai is the essence. So that's the what it is to be. And then usia is commonly translated as substance. So those are different things. And as we saw at the beginning, substance can be the form or the body or the matter or the combination of the two. And he thinks of natural bodies as the preeminent examples of substances. So you can think here of any natural thing, you know, as if you're wondering what substance means. But what he means by saying substance is the cause of existence in all things is not clear to me.
See, mine says essence is the cause of existence for all things.
Yeah, that's bad. So that really does conflate the two things that I suggested we not conflate essence and substance.
So. So let's see, what is this? This one that says, now it is so as substance is clear. For all things, the reason for their being is their substance, and living is the being of living things, and the soul is the cause and principle of this. Again, the actuality is the rationale of that which potentially is something. But it is also clear that the soul is the reason for the body as that for which it is. For just as the mind acts for the sake of something, in the same way does nature, and this is its end.
Yeah, so there's the final cause part, with the soul being the end of the body's actions. It's as if, like, living is the purpose of these faculties, for instance. You know, say, what's the purpose of generation, nutrition, all that stuff? It's being alive. So that's the sense in which it's an end or a purpose.
So it might seem weird that the form and the final cause are the same thing, but thinking back to the blender example, if you take the mechanism as the form, well, it's being a blender is the final cause, and it's being a blender and having that mechanism, I guess, are the same. Although really, couldn't you have a blender with any number of different kinds of particular structures, so the form is not the same, even if in fact one and the same blender is accomplishing its successful functioning as a blender and its success in functioning at all. In other words, the fact that it moves around through the same mechanism doesn't mean that all blenders have to have that mechanism. So it seems like that those are separable in the abstract, at least. But I guess he's not denying that.
Well, in the case of a particular blender, you say the parts, these parts of the blender and their functions are for the sake of blending. That's the analogy. And if one part stops working, it can no longer fulfill that function. It's a dead blender.
The problem I was having is that the final cause seems to be a higher level of abstraction. And he admits this. I mean, that the soul is the final cause of all these different things. Or you might say being an oak tree is acting as the final cause of this particular acorn and all of its stages of development into becoming an oak tree. But being an oak tree is a generic term, is not just referring to this particular organism, it's referring to all organisms of a particular type. So in some ways it feels strange. This is just a type token distinction issue to say that the form itself, the final cause as form, is determining in the individual case.
Well, this gets us into his metaphysics, where I think it's arguable that it is the same, the one form, even though it's in different bodies. So it's, again, it's been so long since I've studied it, and it's a source of debate on how to interpret that. Because obviously he's rejecting abstract Platonism, in which particulars all participate in one form, and how he handles that is complicated.
Well, and he raises that at the beginning, in the very first section, like, well, if the soul ends up being something that there really just is one world soul kind of thing and everybody's participating in it, then how would we investigate it and how would we figure that out? And he just seems like he just throws that as a question.
Well, yeah, he doesn't want an abstract definition of the soul as, you know, the thing belonging. It's not that we can't do that. We can say generically the soul is what all living things have, but we can't derive anything from that. We can't get at any specific properties. In order to derive anything, we have to look at particular souls of particular types of beings.
You have to get particular midichlorian counts. You can't just talk about soul.
Isn't he trying to preserve uniqueness while talking about what's held in common? So the thing that he's not going to do is say that every soul is part of one uber soul, right? And so that they're all moved as one thing. But insofar as that we could talk about things like wolves, let's, you know, be a little bit hand-wavy here, have the souls of wolves, have something that makes them wolves, wolfness, right? It's also the case that each individual wolf participates in that as an individual, not as all of them being part of one wolf soul. It's a categorization.
I think the problem is here, we don't really have his discussion of this in this text. So we're veering into metaphysics that we have no textual basis for discussing.
Yeah, that's true.
The end of 415b12, furthermore, the actuality is the principle, that is the logos, of that which is such potentiality. So it's actually saying, if we say the soul is an actuality, and here he's saying an actuality is a logos. I mean, a logos is not an individual thing. It is a generic, it's a principle. So it's like saying that the scientific law itself is coming down and causing something. And maybe this is just a problem I have with final causation in general, and we just can't talk about it anymore, as you said, because we're not reading the right text.
You're interpreting logos as being, the way he's saying it is Mazda saying the law has come alive. The soul is the law come alive, because the logos is the principle and the principle come alive. That's what is not making sense.
Yeah, but I guess this is just the craziness of the word logos, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, does logos always just a generic term like principle? Principle is not something that has any causal factor, function.
So this, it's not logos here, it's arche, principle.
Why does my translation say principle, subscript L? It means it's saying logos is in the Greek. That's wrong?
The Greek is arche. I'm looking at the Greek.
Yeah, but I guess it depends on which sorry, we're 415.
415b12.
Right around there, I have that the logos of what has being and potential is its being fully itself. And I expect that that's actually logos in there. But
where are you looking exactly?
You just won my bet. I had the over-under on whether or not there would be an argument about
logos?
About logos, about whether it was logos or arche in the translation.
The problem is, you know, they're translating arche as first principle, and then often Logos is being translated as first principle as well, although it's often translated as formula as well. So at the very beginning of the paragraph, he's talking about arche as the first principle. The soul is the cause, the itea, and the first principle, the arche of the living body. Then down at this first part, when he's talking about the soul as the cause in the sense of substance, he says the itea and the arche and the logos. So this is probably why they're throwing together the arche part and the logos part. So what does he mean by the logos? Or the arche? I mean, what do we think he means? Mark, you were making it sound like a law, like the, you know, a scientific law that had been reified and...
Well, that's the way that it's translated here. The actuality is the principle of that which is such potentiality. So it sounds like it's a plan. This is what a final cause, this is how this makes sense.
This isn't the final cause section. This is the formal cause section.
Then doesn't what I was about to say is not going to work then. Because what I was thinking in terms of a blender, you come up with, before you even have any materials in front of you, a schematic, a plan for a blender, and the logos would be the plan.
Yeah.
So I think we can just think of this as the sense in which the form of something is necessary for its functioning. You know, and it differs from final cause because the final cause suggests it's tending towards some end. And here we're talking about the way in which something has to be structured to have a certain form to work correctly, and axe has to have its form, and or the blender has to be...
Correctly doesn't mean it's aiming at an end. Isn't that correctly?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Can I reference the commentary?
Please, yes.
Okay.
We should use the commentary as a deus ex machina to solve all of our problems here.
Okay. So... the commentator says in 415a, 16 to 20, but if we must say what each of them is, and he's talking about the powers, what is the faculty of understanding or of perception or of nutrition, we must again first say what thinking and perceiving are. For activities, energeia, and actions, pragoin, are in respect of an account, logos, prior to their potentialities. A capacity, a power, a potentiality, or a soul part, this is the commentary, is always the capacity for some activity. So activities are defined by their objects. For example, if you claim you are engaged in sensing, we would ask you what you are sensing. If nothing, then you aren't really sensing. If the object you are sensing is sound, then you are hearing. If it's color, then you are seeing. For Aristotle, the form of the object is also the defining form of the activity. It's what Aristotle calls the order of nature. The objects that we eat, sense, or think determines what the activity is. So the logos, I guess, in this sense, is somehow the structure that points towards the object of the activity. It's not the end, but the pointing towards, as opposed to the organizing principle.
It can mean both of those things, yeah.
Yeah, I'm having trouble figuring out what the object is outside of a particular context like perception. That you can talk about the perceptual object, but if you're then talking about the, well, and the intellective object is the ideas that you're thinking of.
Well, for the nutritive, it's food.
Okay.
And it's food in the case both of growth and of reproduction.
And what is the locomotive object?
The thing that you move towards.
Surely somebody will write a 16-paragraph blog post to correct us on this, Mark, after we get the episode out. Somebody out there will help us out.
Do you know that the locomotive soul is sometimes translated as the soul train?
That one was good and not dirty. I applaud you.
Well, I think we should thank Eugene T. Gendlin for providing that little bit of commentary. Perhaps we can get him for the after show to clear up everything.
Yeah. So Seth jumped back, and we did skip a lot of... I forced us to skip interesting stuff. Interesting, well, not to Mark, but maybe to the rest of us.
Is there an additional point you want to bring up as part of a, or do you want to just move toward a closing?
Are we ready to close?
Chronologically, I think we're in fine shape to close.
How far were we supposed to go today? What's our...
It's book one and two, but if we want to talk more about book two when we're doing the second part, that's fine. Just we're adding book three to our plate.
Because we didn't talk about perception, really, to leave that to next time. Yeah.
No, and that would it would make sense since we're talking about the philosophy of mind, except insofar as perception is taken as not really mental at all, that it is a matter of like causing like, and this is the kind of way that he talks about it in a very mechanical sort of way, which seemed to be why he could say, before we cleared it up today, by saying, no, animals do have phenomenology. They have a phenomenal realm. It's just that they don't have the intellect. They can't think about numbers and things. They can't have abstract thought. What I had in mind is that the intellect part, book three, was going to add the whole realm of the mental, and that you could be basically a behaviorist about animals, at least about bugs, and still say that they have desires and they have movements toward things and they have pain and pleasure, just sort of talking purely behavioristically without making any commitments beyond that. Not that you're necessarily denying, again, that many animals have a richer mental life than that.
Well, I've never heard Aristotle interpreted as a behaviorist, but that's, that's one direction.
Any more thoughts that need to be gotten out now? Because the holidays will have happened before next time, and that will be a logos that will transform us into probably some cheer. There might be some spirits involved. Maybe your heart will grow two sizes that day. Three sizes, maybe. So I guess this is kind of like the Athenians voting on things drunk and then voting on them sober, that we'll have this time pre-holiday and then post-holiday to contemplate some of the same issues. So hopefully it will enrich our perspectives. And I will read more of this line-by-line commentary since I just discovered it today myself.
Same here.
Well, there you go. I also listened to today, just to bring it full circle, the History of Philosophy, the Peter Adamson History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps version. He has a nice short episode on what he finds cool about De Anima, and then has the next episode on the rest of Aristotle's biology/zoology, which I also thought it was very helpful to read the Stanford Encyclopedia. And I think the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy, too, has one on just Aristotle's biology in general, where it's kind of like De Anima maybe is part of that, or at least has an interesting discussable relationship to that, but really what other folks are talking about by his biology is all this stuff on the history of animals and then on the movement of animals. And there are a few other texts there, some of which are, you know, straight up just here's a bunch of facts that he's from his explorations. It's not field journals. You know, apparently he did dissections and things like that, but we don't have any his direct accounts of those. We just have his conclusions that he came to from these things. I guess this is laid out in the posterior analytics that he sees the scientific method is first you just lay out a bunch of facts. You just discover what different animals have in common, blah, blah. And then as a second part of it, you get at the principles, you get at the causes. So you synthesize them after the fact. So I don't know if Aristotle's habit here is what gave us the classical view that guys like Thomas Kuhn then had to tell us was all wrong. No. You don't just start with a bunch of facts and then synthesize them. You approach inquiry with some particular purposes in mind, and that's what determines even what you call a fact, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I found this glimpse, such as we got it, into Aristotle's, I don't know if I want to say nitpicky, obsessive, compulsive, I don't know, but very analytical system here. It's kind of neat. Other closings, thoughts?
It requires secondary literature to appreciate and multiple translations to triangulate.
I mean, yeah, if we had time to sit down and think through the structure of the whole thing and what he's trying to do. But the commentary for something this dense and complex and then the amount of time we have, I think it is kind of essential for this.
It makes the logos come alive.
Otherwise, it looks like the way Bark has been describing it, just as this categorization, and in other words, it doesn't seem to have any real functional organization, ironically. It looks more like repetition of classifications. But I really do think it is more than that. I think, you know, I took a passage at some point and just really sat down and thought about that one. It's an interesting alien way of looking at the world, which I think is actually valuable. And I just wish I understood it better. So
this to me explains why in the ancient philosophy class he had with R.J. Hankinson that I think I got, I'm not sure who among you I was in it with, probably neither of you, but I think I got a comment on my, you know, evaluation at the end, like, does not participate in class discussion, because one would not think from listening to this podcast that I would go a whole class not really participating. But when it's going line by line and just talking about the Greek and, like, you know, the couple of ancient Greek dudes that were in the class with me, it's not the means by which I normally communicate.
I don't think I talked in there either, because I mean, yeah. It's a very analytic approach as well. Like, he's not just an ancient Greek philosophy scholar, Hankinson. He's like super analytic scholar.
Yeah. There's no small amount of irony in Hankinson talking about other people not being able to speak in his presence.
Yeah, seriously. Like, the guy he was animated. Let's put it that way.
Animated and verbose. And I love him, and he's a friend, but...
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, he's still here. We're friends on Facebook, and I sent him a honey badger book for his birthday.
So, Dylan, as somebody who was interested in this, I mean, did you have, when you were introduced to this stuff in undergrad, any of this... Perhaps you were just never subjected to this model of offensive ancient philosophy textual dissection that we're musing about.
Well, what you're describing doesn't sound like what I did. I mean, my first exposure to Aristotle was the Politics, and I didn't read any Aristotle until I got to St. John's. And my first experience with that was, it was probably the Physics, which is a terrible book to start Aristotle with. The book you should start Aristotle with is the Ethics, I think. But for me, it makes a big difference to be reading it and talking about it. So I think it probably is true to the extent that, you know, reading multiple translations and also, I suppose, a commentary can help you navigate through a little more quickly to try to also understand what you think he's saying. I've always found it pretty attractive and interesting, if infuriating at times. So I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the conversation. So I would be remiss in not mentioning, since we brought up this line-by-line commentary, the most famous by far line-by-line commentary of all of Aristotle is Thomas Aquinas.
Is there a line-by-line commentary of his line-by-line commentary? Because I might need one.
And it has the Greek.
So it has the translation with the Greek on one side and the English on the other side. And then it has Thomas's commentary with the Latin on one side and the English on the other side, section by section.
Awesome. Oh, my God. I just scrolled down where it has the Latin on the left and the English on the right.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
I just can't even do it unless it also has the German. I need to see how people have translated into German. In cross-reference.
Lectio postquam Aristoteles posuit opinium e lorem de anima in primo libro, in secundo accedit ad determinadium de anima secundum propium.
Yeah, same to you and your mama.
So one of the best things is that Aquinas calls him the philosopher.
The philosopher. Oh, that's awesome.
Anyway.
Well, thanks, guys. Well, we've already said what we're doing next time. We don't have to spend any more time on that. And by the time you listen to this, we'll have already recorded the next one, so you can't jump in and tell us before we do that what we've done wrong. So I'm sorry about that, but that's the nature of time. It's where logos come alive.
Because we're doing the Physics afterwards. After this one, we're doing the Physics.
We will do the metaphysics. We will get to the metaphysics eventually. So, but people should nonetheless get on the blog, and even though it'll be too late, tell us what's wrong here, and maybe we will have an after show. I think we should discuss it to get the right answer from some expert like Eugene or someone else like that. People should become partially examined life citizens and, in fact, start a line-by-line commentary reading of De Anima themselves. That's what I think. We have many people that have become partially examined life citizens or otherwise given us chunks of money. You could do that. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included Brooklyn Zelenka, Gozdi Ozdinler, Reza Saya, Kurt Thomas, Jesus La Rosa, Lukas Stefaniak, Timothy Booth, Paul Niles, Michael DeCamp, Ernest Prabhakar, Stephen Moyer, Mai Nguyen, Steve Lamont, Craig Reukers, Chris Kaidong, Michael Stroud, Michael Ho, Sarah Shih, Michael Armenteros, Billy Chalice, Joseph Schiff, Paul Donahue, Rogers David, Robert Rogers, John Yetter, Scott Diaz, Mary Paschal, Luca Branicki, Stoyanov Minka, Linda Zeno, Randall Rose, Megan Edwards, and Nicola Wilding. Thanks to all of you and the many others who have just done the $5 a month citizen thing or bought something from our little homepage or go to Patreon and you can just set up a dollar recurring donation. That would be enough to make us forever grateful and feel like this is worth our time, that people appreciate us. They don't just write us mean letters saying that we're good in theory, but not in reality.
If you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/store, you're going to see the 2016 Partially Examined Life calendar featuring the ultra-cool artwork of Sterling Bartlett.
Well, what's our call to action today? Seth, what should our call of action be?
Follow us on Twitter.
All right. Do it. Don't do anything else until you do that. Well, good night, everybody. Thanks, guys.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
And because the next thing you're going to hear from us is going to be more about Aristotle's De Anima, the song you're about to hear, which is an instrumental I recorded in 1993, is called The Intermission Song. Thank you.
episode.